the Cohen Multimedia Studio on the grounds of Chautauqua Institution, welcome to CHQ&A, Chautauqua's flagship podcast. I'm Jordan Steves. At CHQ&A, we continue conversations that begin on stages and porches across the Chautauqua grounds. Listen on for even deeper insight into the work and thought processes of some of the celebrated individuals who passed through our gates this summer. On today's episode, we feature two conversations. First is a discussion with Jill Violet, who opened Chautauqua's Week of Lectures on the Art of Play on July 9th. Then, Chautauqua Theater Company Artistic Director Andrew Borba sits with playwright Chelsea Marcantel and champion air guitarist Matt Aristotle Burns. Chelsea's newest play, Airness, is about air guitar competitions. CTC's production of Airness runs July 14th through the 29th on the Bratton Theater stage. But first up is Jill Violet. Jill is founder and CEO of Playworks, a nonprofit that operates on a belief in the power of play to bring out the best in every kid. From its beginnings in two schools in Berkeley, California, Playworks has grown to a staff of 700 and now reaches about 900,000 students in 23 regions around the United States and is present within 1,800 schools and organizations. During the 2015-16 school year, Jill was an education fellow at Stanford's D School, very familiar to us at Chautauqua, where she launched a new project called Substantial, redesigning the way we recruit, train, and support substitute teachers. Prior to Playworks, Jill founded and was executive director for 9 years of the Museum of Children's Art in Oakland, California. And now, my conversation with Jill Violet. Joining us in the Cohen Multimedia Studio today is Jill Violet. She's the founder and CEO of Playworks and spoke in the Chautauqua Amphitheater on Monday, July 9th. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
So for the uninitiated in our listenership here, could you just explain a little bit about what Playworks is, how you founded it, and how it's grown since then?
Sure. So Playworks is a national nonprofit that believes in the power of play to bring out the best in every kid. And we have offices all across the country. I started about 22 years ago. And initially, we were just a direct service program that would hire these amazing young adults and send them into schools, and they would be there full-time, essentially being the sort of nexus of play at a school. But over the years, we've really come to understand that what we want to be building is actually the capacity within schools to do this themselves. Mm-hmm. So we still have our full-time coach model, which is in about 300 schools across the country, but we've also developed a whole range of services that meet schools where they are, and they figure out what their strengths are, what humans and resources they have to make play this robust part of how learning and teaching happen, and then we build on that, and we support them in maximizing their own abilities to ensure that play is a vital part of the school day.
Great. So I'm the principal of a school where Playworks does not have a presence yet. Yeah. What are the next steps for me if I want to make that happen?
Yeah, there are a few different ways. So one thing to do is that we have this really amazing platform called recesslab.org, and you can go to recesslab.org and check it out. There's all sorts of things to read, there are resources. There's actually this really cool thing called the recess checkup that takes about 3 minutes, and you take this little test, and it really is super instructive about how, well, first off, you can find out that your recess is awesome, but you can also find out that, like, oh, here are areas that I can get better at. And then, depending on how you do on the checkup, we then send you targeted, like, little videos that help support you. The other way to sort of think about how Playworks can support schools is at our website, playworks.org. We have all our games. We have our playbook that's free, and that can be downloaded or uploaded. And then we also have services that people can reach out, and we do trainings, and we have trainings that go on in regions that people can attend. And then we have full-time and part-time services.
One of the things I love about recording these conversations after the speakers had a chance to be in the amphitheater is that we have a bevy of questions that weren't able to be asked because of time. And so these two kind of relate to what you were just speaking about in Recess. And it's more of a philosophical kind of question for you. They kind of really could be combined. It's how many rules are needed for games during recess? And if there are too many rules, does play become hard work?
Yeah. You know, we're not so much focused on rules as we are in building a sense of understanding among the students about how to get games going, how to keep games going, how to resolve conflicts. So we really focus in much more of a sort of positive, this is how we play together. And there's this amazing intrinsic motivation in kids to play. And really what they're looking for are just some tools to make the games fun. Mm-hmm. And then I think there is a role for grown-ups in norming kindness and empathy and inclusion and teamwork. And so not that we have some grown-up out on the schoolyard being super, you know, dictatorial about, like, this is how you're going to play. We do pay attention to transitions, like, so we help kids come outside from the classroom and we get them sort of organized for a moment and just have them be sort of conscious about, okay, we're transitioning from being in the classroom to out of the classroom, and now we get to play these different games. And then we very consciously handle the transition back into the classroom, because transitions are where things usually break down. Mm. But it's much more giving kids the tools and skills to successfully navigate and own the play that happens out on the recess yard.
In the 22 years you've had Playworks operating in these schools, and you said during your lecture you've done a ton of data gathering, mm-hmm. on your work. What results have you seen?
Yeah. So about 4 years ago, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funded a randomized control trial. So I'm not an evaluation expert. I always feel like I should put that out in front. But it was, you know, an RCT is the most sort of rigorous form of evaluation. So they looked at 29 schools, 17 that had Playworks, and then 12 in similar conditions that did not have Playworks. And there were four main statistically significant findings. The first was that kids felt safer at Playworks schools, not just during recess, but throughout the school day. And I think fundamentally, feeling safe is just absolutely essential to being able to learn. I mean, I think it's true for being able to do your best work in any kind of situation, but particularly around education, feeling safe is just a prerequisite to success. The second thing they found is we increased vigorous physical activity in a significant way. 43% more vigorous physical activity at Playworks schools than non-Playworks schools. Mm. The third thing was that we recovered instructional time. And from a purely utilitarian kind of economist perspective, right? If you're going to monetize anything in the school day, it's instructional time, right? That is what we are paying for in running our public schools, right? And so being able to recover instructional time, and we're talking about 22 hours per classroom over the course of the school year. Wow. So a significant amount. And in fact, it represents about a 200% return on the cost of the program. So just if you were only going to measure that one bit of it, it really more than pays for itself.
There's
one more thing, and actually it was the aspect that I'm in some ways the least comfortable talking about, but was the aspect that got the most buzz, and that was that teachers at Playworks schools rated bullying 42% lower than at non-Playworks schools. And bullying is such an interesting issue, right? I mean, it's obviously such an important critical issue for us to address, but it's complicated, right? Because we're talking about 10, 11-year-old kids. And so I'm always so reticent, like the bullying sort of implies that there is a bully. Mm. And my experience is that they're just kids. And so when kids are acting in ways that are so sort of counter to like what we would hope would be the social norms, I think you always have to look at what's going on with the grown-ups involved. And
sure.
So,
and they're learning where boundaries are, too. That's part of
right.
this whole process of growing up.
Right. And I think boundaries are such, I mean, we talk about this constraints and boundaries and you know, there's this great philosopher, Johann Huizinga, and I read him initially because he wrote the Waning of the Middle Ages, but he also wrote this incredible book called Homo Ludens on play. Hmm. And he compared play to the sacred. He said, basically, when you're going into play, you're entering into a whole different world. You are agreeing with the people that you play with that for the moment, in that moment in time while you are playing, that all the regular rules don't apply. And in doing that, you agree to take responsibility, not just for yourself, but for the experience of others. And that's a really profound kind of way to think about it. And I think it really points to the power of play to help people feel seen and to really see others.
Yeah. Play is sacred. It feels very at home here at Chautauqua, yeah. that concept.
Yeah.
Have you followed the effects on students into their, you know, early adulthood, into their adulthood? You've now had 22 years
yeah.
worth of...
So no longitudinal studies, but we've had anecdotally just some extraordinary, folks who've come back, you know, later after going into college. And in fact, we have probably 6 or 7 of our current staff who are coaches out in schools were junior coaches for us.
Wow.
In fact, we honored in the Bay Area, we honored a current staff person. He was our rookie of the year, and he'd been a junior coach. And it was one of the most, he gave an acceptance speech, and he talked about how basically getting to be a junior coach saved his life. It was just absolutely the thing that made him want to show up at school every day and made him believe that there was a path forward for him.
What is the Junior Coach Program?
Yeah, so the Junior Coach Program is sort of the structural way that we ensure that kids actually get to own the authority and the leadership on the playground. And so it's usually 15 to 20 kids are identified, usually the oldest kids, so 4th and 5th graders most usually. Hmm. And they get training and they get, they come out in teams to help make sure that the games are going smoothly. So they might turn the jump rope, or they see a conflict, you know, brewing, they ensure that the kids do rock, paper, scissors to resolve it. They're leaders. And I think it's worth noting that some of them are exactly who you'd expect. They're like kids that the teachers identify as having natural leadership ability. Some of them, though, we go out of our way to identify kids who are leading but maybe slightly astray, you know, because leadership is leadership and attention-getting behaviors are attention-getting behaviors. So kids who are resorting to negative attention-getting behaviors often flourish when given the chance to be the recipients of more positive attention.
Hmm. What role does Playworks assume in shaping public policy?
Yeah, policy is a challenging thing in this realm. So we've been involved with some state and local initiatives to create policy. Federal policy, the extent to which we've been involved with that is more around with our coaches. A number of them are come through AmeriCorps, and so we've been involved with the National Service Movement and really advocating for that. I got into this work because I'm so moved by the power of play to bring out the best in kids. I think what continues to fuel me along the way, 22 years in, is that the mostly young adults who come and work with us have this transformative experience of making a difference. Mm-hmm. And I often think about, you know, Tom Brokaw wrote about the greatest generation. And I wonder what's going to be the source of that next greatest generation. Mm-hmm. And I do think that National Service has that possibility.
If you were to design a school, curriculum and the physical space, what sorts of things would you want to see in that school? And what aren't you seeing in the schools that we have currently?
Yeah. It's funny, in some ways, I think school and work aren't that different. And when I think about what I know about what it takes for humans to thrive, right? It's the opportunity to achieve meaning, mastery, and community. And so I think organizing a school in a way that kids really were able to identify their own sense of purpose, and they were given the chance to make meaning of the world around them, and that there was a strong sense of relevance, that would be key. I think that one of the things about play, right, we talk about, I was talking in my in my talk about the definition of play, and that Bernard Suits gave this definition of a game, the voluntary attempt to overcome an unnecessary challenge. But, you know, this, I think what it points to, though, is I think sometimes we mistake kids' lack of interest in school for a lack of interest in challenge. And I think play points to, the willingness of a kid to stand outside until dark practicing the same basketball shot over and over and over and over and over again. I think when kids have more choice and control over the challenges in their lives, mm-hmm. they bring more energy and care to it. And I think that's key.
We're recording in the Cohen Multimedia Studio here on the grounds of Chautauqua Institution. I'm Jordan Steeves. Sitting across the table from me is Jill Violet, the CEO and founder of Playworks. Jill, you just mentioned the workplace, and you also spoke about this in your talk in the amphitheater. What sorts of programs does Playwork have in place now? You're coming up with programs now that you can integrate into workplaces. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no. For a number of years, we've actually worked with our corporate partners to give them engagement opportunities that really help them experience firsthand the power of play and to understand the importance of their investments in our work in schools. And along the way, one of the things we'd hear, which was always sort of striking to me, was like, you know, the idea was we'd bring employees out to play alongside the kids and, you know, volunteer and to see the work. And then I would hear from HR directors, like, that was the best organizational development experience we've had. Like, that, the people got closer, they really got to know each other. People have been talking about it and raving about that experience for, you know, weeks, ever since we mm-hmm. did it. And so we are in the process of launching a new for-profit business that's going to be owned by the nonprofit, which is slightly out of the ordinary, but it's been done. Mm-hmm. And that new for-profit is called Workswell, and it's targeted to corporations that are interested in doing team and culture-building activities using play and design thinking and storytelling to really build a culture that is robust and leads to greater productivity.
So this is another question from the audience from the Monday, July 9th lecture. Much children and adult play depends on athletic skill and capability. How do you address or advise those who are not, don't have those kinds of skills and abilities, whether it's a physical challenge or just they just don't have it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I think of play in a much broader sense than just sport and game. Like, there's free play, there's imaginative play, so play is pretty broad and all-encompassing, right? Any activity undertaken for no apparent purpose.
But I love that definition.
But we do, I mean, the play that happens on the playground is often very physical. And I will also offer, it's also incredibly adaptable, right? It inherent in play, when it's done well, I think, is a spirit of adaptation. Mm-hmm. And I think that really taps into, like, an ethos around inclusion. So we really go out of our way to make sure that there are a range of games available for kids where they see themselves somewhere in one of those games, one of those activities. We go out of our way to make sure that kids with different abilities, physical, developmental, emotional, that they see themselves playing, that they feel welcome, and that they and that the games are sort of by design tweakable so that everyone can play. Mm-hmm. So it's incumbent upon people playing to make an effort to be inclusive, but I think I think that's maybe one of the greatest assets, right? That once people have the experience of playing and going through that exercise of adapting so that everyone is included, you learn without being sort of lectured on it that actually playing with more different people is just better. It's more fun.
Right. And this relates to another question that was asked at the lecture, which is about tailoring play to boys versus girls.
Yeah.
And now this, you know, what's increasingly in our consciousness is children who don't identify as either.
Well, so we, just as a, like, So we were asked about rules earlier. One of our rules is that we don't ever divide kids up by boys and girls. Like, it's just, it's unnecessary. It sets up a potentially uncomfortable dynamic. And there's no benefit. Mm-hmm. Like, to what end? So we just don't do that. Nothing seems to be lost by the absence of, you know, breaking kids up by gender.
Sure. Do video games count as play in your philosophy?
I was joking about how I get asked all the time to say bad things about video games. I'm a fan. I played a fair bit of Zelda in my 20s. Like, I'm not, like, so, there's good video games and there's bad video games. Like, it's a great form of play. And, like all things, like, I'm a fan of moderation, too. So, I think there is, coming along with kids playing games, there is an addictive nature to a lot of screen time. Mm-hmm. And so having grown-ups in their lives who help them understand the power of limits, that's an essential aspect of that being healthy and good. But there are great video games out there, and it does totally count.
I want to talk a little bit about your background. What is it that you experienced in your childhood, adolescence, early adulthood that you think led you down the path that you've taken?
Yeah. Well, so I'll be 54 this month, and so I'm that generation of women who I got to play. I'm sort of post-Title IX, but I often was playing with the boys. Mm-hmm. I was a good athlete. I was a runner, and I played rugby, and I did sports, soccer, and basketball. There's few sports that I don't really love playing. And I had multiple experiences where I remember, as a kid who was also very academic, sometimes feeling kind of other, and I always felt myself when I was playing. Like, I remember as a kid being out playing kickball, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and in the evenings, in the summertime, we'd play these games of kick the can, and mm-hmm. They would just go until dark, and I just, there was a freedom in that, and an ease that I just valued. And then in school, I was also pretty hyper, and getting to run around every day was just essential to my ability to sit down and focus. And I kind of always knew that about myself. And so then growing up, too, playing sports and really on some level, as much as there was discrimination against women in sports in my childhood, there was also, again, a kind of freedom in the fact that my motivation to play was always intrinsically motivated. I wasn't doing it to please anybody or to make some kind of professional team or some more competitive team. I did it for the love of the game. Mm-hmm. So I went off to college, and then right out of college, I started a children's art museum in Oakland, and I always have loved the arts as well, and so I did that for 9 years, and it was in the context of doing that that I was out in schools and saw that recess had dramatically changed, and that, you know, there's two kinds of chaos. There's good chaos and there's bad chaos. I'm super comfortable with good chaos, but I was seeing a lot of bad chaos. And I had a principal ask if I could help make recess better at her school, and it just felt like the right thing to do.
So this is another question from the audience from the July 9th lecture. And I think it relates to the point you just made about art, your love for mm-hmm. art, but also I think an interplay that you can mm-hmm. have between play and art. In addition to these sorts of athletic games or even video games, what does Playworks do to encourage imaginative play?
Yeah, well, I think giving kids a sense of their own agency, right? Like I think that's really perhaps the foundation of kids' imaginative play, right? And I say to our staff all the time that our job is to believe in the best in every kid. And you'll get a kid who's acting every which way to make you really question if you can hold on to that belief. But fundamentally, I think we benefit as a whole society if every member, every individual has the chance to find their best and then to contribute that. And so I think imaginative play is most likely to flourish in environments where kids are getting messages of unconditional love. Mm-hmm. And so I think building a sort of a learning environment and a culture and climate in schools where kids feel seen and have the chance to see others in that true way, ultimately that gives them permission to really let their imagination soar.
And Playworks is present a lot in schools where there is high levels of poverty. Can you talk a little bit about that? You're starting to give voice to those kinds of issues and making, you know, children who maybe don't have the best lives at home,
yeah,
that school can be sort of a refuge for them.
Yeah.
And how does this work relate to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would describe it more as kids living in poverty, right? Mm-hmm. And kids living in poverty sometimes have incredibly caring, loving, supportive families, just like sometimes
sure,
really
yeah.
affluent kids don't have a great home life. So it's not quite so cut and dry, but
sure.
We do target, you know, in the 1800 schools we're serving, we serve independent schools, we serve public schools, we serve parochial schools. We're agnostic in who we serve. We do have the more intensive services that are full-time and that are subsidized. We target for more low-income schools. And the truth is, play is a social justice issue, right? And so it's disproportionately available in more affluent communities. It's not wholesale in that way, right? You can really point to the fact that in more affluent communities, kids tend to be going from one structured activity to the next, and they're less likely to have the chance for unsupervised free play where they figure out how to make their own rules up, and some of the stuff around self-regulation.
Mm.
And clearly there's still bullying behaviors and other stuff that happen in affluent communities. But we really are interested in figuring out how might we leverage the power of play to ensure that, particularly in low-income schools, that play is available as a tool to help kids fully find the best in themselves and explore identity and ultimately have that kind of agency that enables them to be drivers in their own education.
Sure. I want to talk briefly about another project you've worked on. You were an education fellow at Stanford's D School, where you learned the process of design thinking. It's a familiar concept to us at Chautauqua. We've had George Kemble speak here several times. You were looking specifically at a problem of substitute teaching in schools, and the fascinating statistic that, of course, makes sense when you think about it, that at any given time, 1 in 9 1 in 10 teachers standing in front of a classroom is not that classroom's full-time trained teacher.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about where you recognize that this was a problem and what the steps are you're taking to...
Sure. So the genesis was that I was out in all these schools visiting for Playworks, and I kept having this recurring experience where the principal would at some moment sort of take me aside and ask, in this sort of very plaintive, desperate way, if they could borrow their Playworks coach to fill in because they'd had a teacher absent for multiple weeks and they'd been farming the kids out to other teachers and their teachers were going to walk and they were just at the end of their ropes. And they'd explain that, like, the Playworks coach had such incredible trust and rapport with the kids, and if they could just fill in for, like, a week as a sub, like, and I would always say, no, that's not their job, they can't do that. But it happened in, like, so many different places and so frequently that I, you know, as one does, ask the Google, like, what's up with substitute teaching? And so that's where I, you know, learned all these stats that, you know, it's at any moment in time, 10% of the teachers standing in front of American classrooms are subs. So fully a year of a kid's K-12 education is being taught by these folks.
Hmm.
And then compounding it, right? 90% of districts offer 4 hours or less of training for subs. You know, it's just... The numbers are pretty staggering. We spend $4 billion a year on subs. So I think I am, especially having spent 22 years working in, like, recess, I am attuned to this truth that there are tweaks that can be made in the educational system that have outsized, eye-popping value, right? That they disproportionately, they don't just change the thing you're working on, but they change the whole climate. Mm-hmm. And I became convinced that substitute teaching was one of those things.
And so you've begun this organization called Substantial.
Right.
What is the mission and goal of that organization?
Yeah, so Substantial, and the website's substantialclassrooms.org. And the mission is really to co-create with districts and schools alternatives to the way that they're currently recruiting, training, and supporting substitute teachers. And the idea is we've created a data tool that I think is really powerful. Because one of the, I think, the big obstacles is there is this level of hopelessness and resignation about the sort of the whole topic that then leads people to sort of avoid it. And it's an incredibly data-rich environment, mm-hmm. and just taking a little bit of effort to synthesize and make some meaning out of the data, it really shifts the challenge from being this sort of monolithic, intractable problem to something with some low-hanging fruit. Like, you come to understand, oh, our problem isn't just all of our schools, it's these five specific schools that have a problem with subs. Or, you know, oh, our problem isn't that, you know, we don't have any sub, we just don't have any short-term subs. We have lots of long-term subs because we have retired teachers. Or, you know, each district, I suspect that when we get deeper into it, they're going to be archetypes, that they're going to be certain districts have different patterns. But in the meantime, we're just helping districts and schools look at their specific challenge and figure out ways, again, getting back to that idea we were talking about earlier, right? Subs, like anybody, need the chance for meaning, mastery, and community. And as a school or as a district, how might you create an environment that offers more of that for folks who you're inviting into your classrooms?
Well, I hope that message and your message on play continues to find its way in the areas of the country where it still hasn't reached, because it's an important one. And we're so glad to have had you here this week, Jill. Jill Violet is the founder and CEO of Playworks. And where can they find out more information about your work?
Sure. So playworks.org is our website. And then substantialclassrooms.org is for the Substitute Teaching Project. And my own website is jillviolet.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being so generous with your Chautauqua time. And we'll release you back out so you can have more of the Chautauqua experience.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Jill Violet for joining us on CHQ&A today. Next up is a conversation between Chautauqua Theater Company Artistic Director Andrew Borba and two individuals who are involved in very different ways on the company's new production of Erinus, running July 14th through the 29th in Bratton Theater. Chelsea Marcantel is the playwright behind Erinus, and also Everything is Wonderful, Ladyish, Devour, and Tiny Houses, which CTC produced as part of its new play workshop in 2016. Erinus was recently honored with the 2018 Elizabeth Osborne New Play Award by the American Theater Critics Association. Matt Burns is a special guest at Chautauqua this week. He is a waiter and world-class competitive air guitarist living in New York. Matt decided to try air rocking almost a decade ago when he saw the documentary Air Guitar Nation, and has since become a two-time champion at Air Guitar World Championships. And now, Andrew Borba's conversation with Chelsea Marcantel and Matt Aristotle Burns.
Joining us in the Cohen Multimedia Studio today is Chelsea Marcantel, playwright of Erinus, and Matt Aristotle Burns, a two-time reigning world air guitar champion.
Let's go!
And we are going to be talking today about Erinus, air guitar, and all things...
make-believe.
Make-believe. Fantastic. Yes. Chelsea, let's start with you. I mean, I saw this play down at the Humana Festival, and of course loved it, loved the play, loved the energy of it, loved the writing of it, and we just had to do it up here. Can you tell us just a little bit about sort of where it came from, what your exposure to air guitar was?
The play is about the world of competitive air guitar, which is a real thing, and that Aristotle will tell us more about shortly. That I've known about for a while, for probably about 10 years. I used to know someone when I lived in Chicago that was a competitor, and I would go to these competitions and just didn't get it at that time. I thought, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. I don't understand why people spend their real money doing this imaginary thing. This seems like people who just don't have enough, like, to occupy themselves. And then when I was thinking about possible... What I do when I write a play is usually the first thing I find is, like, a world that I want to live in for a while. And so when I was thinking about writing a play a couple of years ago and thinking about worlds that would be fun to live in, because my previous couple of plays had been pretty heavy, I remembered this air guitar thing, and I did a little bit, just a modicum of research into it, and then I think I'm at the point in my life where I was, like, ready to receive it, because I got completely fascinated, just went straight down a wormhole, and came out the other side with this play about a girl who, much like me, at the time that I knew about it, at the beginning of the play, thinks that this is kind of dumb. She wants to win, and it's because she kind of has an ulterior motive, and then she thinks it's going to be really easy for her because she's in a real band. And she quickly realizes that the only way to get ahead in this world is to take it very seriously and to put your heart out there and to be earnest and sincere. And so it's also comedy. I don't mean to make it sound like a think piece, but... yeah, that's kind of where it came from, and now we're all making this thing together.
Yes. You mentioned something the other day about sort of finding the joy that the kids on the, on the plaza had, and I really have to say that for me is the resonance of this play. It is the pursuit and the exercise of joy that way. Was that something that was intentional for you? Was that something that you, like, did you know that's where it was going when you started writing the play?
I don't think so. I always say I'm interested in humans as small group primates. So I'm interested in humans that have a found family or a shared value system that's more important to them than the value system of mainstream society. And that's what I thought I was writing a play about when I started. You know, a group of people that are very close, and then their priorities are different from ours. And then the more that I delved into it, the more I thought, like, oh, this is a world full of people who are collaborative, and they're enthusiastic, and they're full of love for each other, and they're totally unselfconscious. So it's almost like all of the best parts of making theater reflected back to me in this community that I previously didn't know anything about. And it became a play about joy, and it became a play about letting your guard down. But that's not what I set out to write. Those are the things that I learned from observing and researching the community.
Speaking of someone who has no guard, let's bring in Aristotle into the conversation.
What up?
How'd you two meet? How did this relationship begin?
I met Chelsea on a whim. It was kind of so I've been competing in air guitar competitions for quite some time. And a buddy of mine, my friend Jason, who I grew up doing children's theater with, in my hometown, Staten Island, New York. Once I was like 18, 19, I had kind of stopped acting. Because I think that's when you get to the age where if you want to continue to act, you have to pursue it really hard. And I kind of really didn't know what I wanted in life at that time. So I'd done all these plays with my friend Jason growing up. And he ended up pursuing it. He went to Tisch, graduated, and really, really went after it. And he's the one who saw the original casting call for Airness. And he saw it and sent me over a message saying, dude, look at this. And I remember getting the casting call and freaking out because, you know, in our play, we have amazing characters named Golden Thunder and Facebender. And in real life, there are air guitarists named Nordic Thunder and Face Melter. And I looked at that and I was like, who wrote a play about me and my friends? What's going on here? Who's been, like, hiding behind a bush, like, just peering out, writing this stuff down? So he said, unbeknownst to me, my good pal Jason wrote Chelsea an email saying, hey, I have a friend who is uniquely qualified to be in your show. You should check him out. And Chelsea, of course, was like, yes, I looked him up, bring him on in.
I'm familiar with his work.
Yes. Yeah. So I remember the initial audition, it was for Humana, which I found out is a big deal. And at the time, though, based on how I knew my friend Jason, I thought I was auditioning for like a community theater piece or like a student project or something like that. So I remember going into the audition room and sitting down in the I had never been in a professional audition space before, and it's kind of got like a claustrophobic feel to it, right? All the walls are very bare, and everyone's doing their vocal warm-ups and everything. And I remember sitting down, and it was like a movie moment where I looked to the left and I looked to the right, and these actors were doing some pretty intense, like, and like, lion face. And I was like, huh, wonder what's going on over here. And I, like, you know, after a couple minutes, kind of like, I started opening my eyes a little bit, and I was like, maybe, like, there might be mics in this production. That would be pretty exciting. This might, like, be some money in this community theater project. Hooray, hooray. And after a while, I was like, I don't know what's going on, but this is bigger than I think it is. So, now I'm from the world of competitive make-believe, right? And so, yeah. I remember looking around the room, as soon as they called me in for the audition, I stood up, and I had, at the time, my championship belt in my backpack. I had brought it with me. And I looked around at kind of the room, and I reached in and kind of whipped out my championship belt, like, above my head, like a championship wrestler. And I put it on in front of everybody in the room and kind of walked in all head high, right on into the audition. And I was super excited about it, but I also walked into the audition ready to say no to it, because the air guitar community is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful group of people. We have a lot of fun. We always try to have a good time. We encourage everybody to join us in having a good time. But from the outside looking in, it is such a silly, kind of dumb way to have such a good time. That a lot of people want an air guitarist on their show or something like that to make fun of them. Like, they kind of bring them on to kind of mock what they're doing. And it's something that's so silly where it's like, I have no problem going on to a show and giving it, like, an honest shot at being entertaining and then end up getting made fun of or teased or whatever. Like, because I understand why people wouldn't be interested in something so over the top and so loud and so silly. But I'm not cool with getting brought in to be made fun of. So I walked into the audition not knowing too much about the play. Ready to be like, hey, good luck, it's just not for me, thanks, it's not what we're about. And I remember reading it, and, like, my jaw dropped. I was like, how did this writer understand that there's more to air guitar than just pretending to play the guitar? It's about a community of people who just relentlessly support each other, in the pursuit of having a good time, a good, safe, fun time. And, that's how I was introduced to Chelsea and Airness as a whole.
It is, after having watched a run through last night, it was, Chelsea, you and I were speaking about this, but it's amazing to me that you have been able to balance exactly that. You have captured all of the fun of this, but have taken it very seriously, and the characters do take it very seriously in the way that anyone, you know, I have things that I do that the rest of the world would consider to be absolutely foolish. Theater being one of them.
Exactly.
But there is that sort of it's the earnestness and the integrity that everybody's pursuing it by, which is, I find deeply moving in its way, and yet makes it more fun.
Yeah, that's the only way that comedy works. I mean, to me, I think the funniest thing in the world is people that take something too seriously, right? So it's fun and it's funny, but we're not making fun of anyone. We're not sending anyone up. No one is the butt of the joke. Mm-hmm. We're all in on the joke.
Yeah.
And that's very true to the air guitar community as well. Yeah. I think when you go to a show, it's like, we all know we're playing air guitar, but come with us to a world where that is the most important thing any of us could be doing tonight. Yeah. And if you're down to go on that ride, then you have just a fantastic night.
That's the truth. I mean, like, like Chelsea said earlier, this is a real thing. For those of you who are listening and don't believe it, there are air guitar competitions that are held in pretty big venues. I performed in front of 10,000 people with absolutely nothing, you know? And it's like you said, though, the only way it works, it's that the crowd, instead of showing up and being like, he didn't play a G, this is ridiculous, they're kind of in on the joke. They're in to support the rock stars, quote unquote, that they're watching in front of them. And it's fun for the crowd because they're almost part of the, they're such a big part of the energy of the show. An air guitar contest is kind of like a lip sync contest, or like, I like to call it drag for frat bros. And there's such an appeal to someone who is having that much fun being that silly, that it's just hard not to smile and chuckle, and it's hard not to cheer for them when you're at a show drinking heavily.
So, Jesse, I want to know what your response was when he came into that first audition, belt, wearing the belt.
So the it's a movie moment. So the other side of the camera is that, or the other side of the screen in the split screen is that he was the only person we called in for the role of the announcer because we thought the play was still coming together and it wasn't a very big part of the time. And we thought maybe we can use pre-recorded voice or we can use one of the apprentice actors at Actors Theater of Louisville. We don't have to bring someone from New York. And but when we found out he was interested in coming in from his friend, I was like, we have to see this guy. If he can put a sentence together, then we have to have him in the show. And so Meredith McDonough, the original director, and Jenny Koons, who was our movement director, and I were all sitting in the rehearsal room. And I think you came in at like 12:30 or something. So we had been in there all morning, just like peeking out into the hall every once in a while to be like, is he here? Is he here yet? Is there a star? And so when he came into the room, we just all fangirled out. We like wanted to take a picture with the bell, you know, like we were super excited. And it's, we were at the disadvantage, we were at the advantage because we knew everything about you and you thought you were auditioning for community theater production. So we were just excited. And then, we were just excited to meet him. And then he came in and he did the reading of the announcer lines and was so charming and funny and just naturally charismatic that we were like, we gotta have this guy in the show. And it was the best decision we could have made because, Matt's an incredibly generous collaborator and showed up to rehearsals he wasn't called to just to see if there was anything he could do to help make the show better that day, and has continued in exactly the same spirit here at Chautauqua.
Right. Can we talk a little bit about that? You're teaching all the cast members air guitar in a crash course.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Is that difficult? Is that, are you...
It's exciting because, so one real treat I think about going to air guitar competitions is that most of the people who enter these competitions aren't actors or not performers. They're accountants who want to do something different this weekend. And they hear about this contest and they're like, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. It's only 60 seconds and I drink for free all night if I sign up. I'm doing it, you know? So a lot of people have asked me to help, you know, coach them and teach them and stuff like that. But it's, they're not actors or performers and stuff, so there's you have to teach them kind of how to perform before you teach them how to perform in this specific thing, you know, cheat out, show your face, play to the back row, that kind of whole, those kind of basics, which is why it's insane. When Aaron is picked up, I had never taught air guitar to theater. Theater kids, not kids, but theater kids.
Yeah. We'll always be theater kids.
Yeah, exactly. People who have just like really good instincts and they know what to do and they know how to perform and they know just naturally how to work a crowd. So those kind of training sessions have been insanely fun. And the fact that this cast in particular is able to pick this up as good as they did in 2 weeks, which is something that I really want to stress. It's so impressive that this cast has class in the morning. They're all working on other plays. They have to do all the work for this play. And on top of that, learn choreography for like a dance style, if you want to call it that, that they've never really attempted before. And they're killing it. They make it so easy for me to like look good because they're just so good, you know? And it's just been an absolute blast working in that capacity. It's also really fun because they're still, you know, they're still grad students right now, so their minds are still being molded into
Or warped, as the case may be.
Tomato, tomato. and they're asking such good questions. They're asking, you know, it might sound silly, but, you know, they're asking, like, am I shredding too fast before I go down the neck of the guitar? They're like, if I throw the guitar in the air, pause, smoke a cigarette, catch the guitar without missing a beat, is that going to work? Are the judges going to take any points away? And I'm like, away? No. Bonus points? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So it's been a pleasure working with the entire cast and crew. Everybody in the room has made it so fun to work. And it's, for a play like this, it's literally one of those things where, like, can't believe I'm going to work.
And
I can't wait to get there, you know? Like, I'm going to have more fun today working than I am not. And it's a blast. It's an absolute blast.
Excellent. I'm going to divert just a little bit. Sure. You're the reigning world champion.
Yes,
sir. When are the next... What's that mean? When's the next competition?
So a little history, I guess, on, like, how, like, on how competitive air guitar has gotten to this point. Mm-hmm. And how I got to that point. So competitive air guitar started in Finland in the mid-90s. A bunch of college kids had a homework assignment, and it was realistically, guys, how could you come up with world peace? Realistically, how could you do that? And they were all like, well, if everybody in the world picked up an air guitar, and theoretically, nobody could be holding a rifle, boom! That is a cost-effective method to ensure world peace. So competitive air guitar started up in Finland as a world peace promotion. And slowly by slowly, other countries found out about this and started to get involved. Air Guitar World Championships, it's kind of like FIFA. Mm-hmm. And U.S. Air Guitar is kind of like Major League Soccer. It's like the American branch of the Air Guitar World Championships. Mm-hmm. And all these countries, there's the German Air Guitar Championships, Japanese Air Guitar Australia, all these countries have kind of joined on for this idea that we could promote world peace by having the most fun we possibly could, the most contagious good time, and that would be a blast. So that's kind of how air guitar started, and it really exploded in the early 2000s. The Finnish version of the Music Video Awards was held in the same town that the Air Guitar World Championships were going on. So they kind of tagged the Air Guitar World Championships as kind of like a side attraction to the Finnish Air Guitar, the Finnish Music Video Awards. Yeah. And very quickly, air guitar became the bigger attraction than the Finnish Music Video Awards. The U.S. found out about this in 2003. We had our first competitions here in the States, and we ended up winning Worlds the first year that we were involved with it. Mm. And I found out about this in 2008 because a documentary called Air Guitar Nation, check it out, folks. A friend of mine saw this documentary in, like, the bargain bin at, like, Best Buy or something like that. And he put it on. He went home, watched 20 minutes of it, turned it off, called me, and was like, "Dude, you have to come over and watch this movie right now." So I watched it, and my first thought was like, "This is just the stupidest, dumbest, most ridiculous, gorgeous, beautiful performance art that I'd ever seen in my entire life." And I immediately wanted to sign up for it, and I did. I had just graduated high school, and I signed up for a competition. And my first contest ever, I ended up tying for first place with another guy who, it was also his first contest ever. The mighty Windhammer from Philadelphia. Mm. What a fierce, fierce rivalry we have. Rob, love you, bud. You're a great guy. So the next year, I wanted to compete again, but unfortunately, I was only 19 at the time. And Jose Cuervo was the sponsor of the tour that year. And they took a look. One looked at me, and I have kind of like a baby face, I guess. I look a little younger than I am. So they were like, no, not even with a fake ID. Like, no way, that kid's 12. He's not, he can't compete. So they kind of banned me from competing, and I was having none of that because I got bit by the bug super hard. I couldn't wait to get back up and melt some faces. So I went to Philadelphia to return because I wanted my rematch against Windhammer, who had bested me the year before. And I showed up 5 hours early before the contest started. It was at this bar in Philadelphia. And I waited across the street with, like, reading the newspaper, like, over my face kind of thing. And when the bouncers changed shifts, I ran into the venue. I ran into a bathroom stall and just hid in there for, like, 4 hours. Pretend I had the flu or, like, the stomach flu or something. And when the venue filled up, I was able to walk around. And I ended up competing that night. And this is, like, a nationwide thing. And, like, it got me kind of, like, a lot of street cred in the air guitar community. Like, the people in San Francisco are like, do you hear about this kid, Aristotle from Philly? He's sneaking into bars, but he's not drinking. It's for a fictional instrument competition. And ever since then, I've been competing and going all over the world. I was able to win my first... So the contest nationwide is structured almost like a college basketball bracket, mm-hmm. right? And you need to win a contest to move on to the next level, to move on to the next... So you need to win, for example, the Queens qualifier... to move on to represent New York in the East Coast semifinal. And you need to win the East Coast semifinal to represent the East Coast at the national championships. And if you win the national championships, you represent America in the world finals in Finland, where you have to go against all the champions from all over the world. And fortunately, I was able to win a whole bunch of times, and eventually I was able to take the gold home for a good old US of A. Let's go. And I'm excited for this year. I'm one of four people to ever win two world titles in the 20 plus years that this has been going on. So if I am able to win a third at the end of August 25th, I believe, I will be the first person in the history of our species to be able to say I have... Melted more faces.
The three-peat.
And blown more brains. Yeah, exactly. The three-peat.
So, the season is going on now, to answer your question. It's all happening now. The national championships is in August, mm-hmm. and then the world championships is in August. But because Aristotle is the reigning champ, he doesn't have to compete again until Finland.
Yes.
So this is his training. Aaron's rehearsal is his
training. I was
going to
say, it's good that you're working out, because I'd be afraid 100%. You were getting rusty.
No, it's very true. I only compete once a year, as opposed to... I used to compete 4 or 5 times a summer. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to stay loose and fresh and getting ready for it. So Aaron's is a great way. I take some Zumba classes every now and then just to stay in shape for it. It's a perfect workout for air guitar because it's such ridiculous, elaborate motions. So you don't want to get gas before the second round.
I'm just imagining you at the Staten Island YMCA in a room full of... 70-year-old women.
Oh, yeah.
Doing Zumba.
No, I prefer to do it in a room of 70-year-old women because even if it's my first class, I'm going to be good. I'm going to be really good. And they're so nice, too. Like, come on, Ethel, get those knees up. Yes! Yes!
So I think our last question is one that in many ways, the play is investigating. So you can answer it as you will.
Sure.
But this idea of airness, mm-hmm. what it is, and the pursuit of it. Right. So it's a word that is used in air guitar championships.
Absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely.
So how would you describe airness to those of us who have not been initiated?
So an air guitar contest is judged on three. There's three criteria that the judges are looking for in a performance. The first is your technical merit, which is the most objective thing. Does it look like my hands are... Does it look like I'm playing what you're hearing out of the speakers? The second is your stage presence, which is kind of the character, the costume. Did you bring pyro with you? Is the crowd into your routine? If you're portraying a villain, which a lot of people like to do... are they booing? It's a lot like wrestling in that sense. Like TV wrestling, you know, Hulk Hogan getting everybody riled up. And then finally, the final criteria is airness. And airness, it's almost impossible to define. You just know it when you see it. Airness, it's the it factor. If you've ever seen somebody lip sync and do a great job with it, and you can't help but laugh. Like, you can't really explain why it is so good. It just is. My favorite definition is that what you're watching has transcended the act of imitation and become an art form in and of itself. So this person has stopped pretending to play the guitar, and he's playing air guitar. and he's totally caught up in the moment, and he just looks like he's having the best time of his life. He doesn't even see the 10,000 people screaming in front of him. He's just in the zone, caught up in the music, caught up in the moment, and just it's a pretty intense 60 seconds when you're up there.
I would compare it, if I had to compare it, to really good drag. I think that's the best comparison. When you see really good drag, the performer is not a man pretending to be a woman. She is an amazing drag performer doing amazing drag. Mm-hmm. It's its own separate thing. It's not about imitation anymore. It's about creation. It's very hard to explain, but I guarantee it, you will know it when you see it.
Right. Exactly.
And I will say, as someone not one of the performers in the show, but as a witness to it, there is also, as when the performers are reaching airness, we as an audience have our own sense of airness. We are actually transported into the moment. Mm-hmm. It really is about being present in the moment as a witness. Thank you both so much. We're here with Chelsea Marcantel, the playwright of Airness, Matt Aristotle Burns, two-time reigning world air guitar
champion.
We are pushing, voting, we're willing him towards that three-peat.
Fingers crossed. Good looking out, guys. Good looking out. Appreciate it.
Very much appreciative. Come see Airness. It will be a great time.
Come see Airness, people! Yeah!
Thanks to Jill Violet, Chelsea Marcantel, and Matt Burns for joining us on CHQ&A today, and to guest interviewer Andrew Borba. Our producers for this program were Thomas Mitchell, Vincent Nelson, and Michael Earle. A version of this program may also air as Chautauqua Chronicles on WRFA 107.9 FM, listener-supported radio in Jamestown, New York. CHQ&A is a production of Chautauqua Institution, recorded in the Cohen Multimedia Studio. I'm Jordan Steves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back shortly with another episode of CHQ&A.